Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and today Rusty's sitting with me to co-host. And this show idea was yours, Rusty. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Doug?
Doing awesome. And this is, I think this is your title. So mentally and emotionally committing to leaving work. And this is a lot of mindset stuff in here. So we're going to go through a lot of your outline, and some of the big things I think that I really identified with, or I observe people like really needing to build an identity outside of work. And one of yours that you mentioned is like making very big sort of requests and ask your employer for stuff when you kind of know you're on the way out. So for the people that haven't heard the previous episode that you have been on, Rusty, what's your story?
Yeah, so my name's Rusty. I was on a few months ago. I love this podcast, so I'm excited to be back doing it again. And just very briefly, our story that led up to fire. I was working as an attorney at a big law firm, a few different big law firms in Chicago. I discovered fire through Carl's blog. I pulled the trigger on early retirement. My wife and I both did when we were 36, and we had a son, moved to Colorado. Now we live in Boulder and Breckenridge and enjoy skiing and hiking and biking and the mountains. That's kind of where we're at now.
Awesome. We'll link up so people could find the other episodes that you've been on. And, you know, one of the interesting things and one of my observations, it's like when people are super productive at work, and a lot of people in the fire community are like very productive, they're type A, they get shit done. When you go from that to maybe not being productive in a traditional sense, like people kind of lose their mind a little bit. And a lot of this is all around mindset, and it gets into identity and all that kind of stuff. And your career is one that, I mean, I think there's like doctors and lawyers and some other professionals. I used air quotes. They're true professionals. I shouldn't have put that in air quotes, but like professional jobs where your identity is really closely related, but you seem to have escaped it pretty well. Again, just an observation, but it is a tough thing. And, you know, I learned this from Carl. You probably heard, you know, his march in the urgency to get to FI, like got him working even harder and doing even right. more stuff. And it's like, you get even more acclimated to being busy. So any thoughts on that before we kind of hop into the outline here?
I do think it's hard. I think doctors probably have it the hardest. I mean, their whole identity literally gets wrapped into work. I mean, they change their name to, you know, have the MD afterwards, and the level of training that they have to go through is so intense. When I talk to my friends who are doctors about early retirement, they can't even fathom the concept of ever retiring. On top of that, they do probably more good for the world than lawyers do. They like are helping sick people. They're like, literally, if I quit my job, people will die. Whereas I had some pretty high stakes stuff in my legal career, but nothing to that extent. But when you become a lawyer, you definitely get a level of status. I mean, when people ask you at a cocktail party what you do, most people don't have to feel sheepish about saying that they're a lawyer. And the other component of it is like your parents don't have to, you know, your parents are happy to go around and tell their friends that they're, you know, that their kid got into law school or their kid's a lawyer. And, you know, in my case, like working at a big law firm, parents love that. Yeah. And I was definitely pulling that away, or you're losing that. If I'm at a cocktail party now, it's interesting for me. When I was even at a cocktail party, when I was a lawyer, I was never super excited when that was the direction that things went. And then especially people will start asking you about legal situations or legal adjacent situations. And I'm like, this is my few hours of the week where I get to socialize and have fun. Like, if you want to talk to me about the law, that is really, that's about the least fun conversation that I could have. Now that I'm done working, I mean, I can still say I'm a lawyer. I guess I I technically am. I don't practice law, but I, you know, I have all the credentials. I would have to take a few. I would have to take a few continuing legal education classes to get my license active again. But I'm still technically a lawyer. I still have to register with the state of Illinois, and as an inactive lawyer, you lose some of that status. And I think lawyers in particular, they're some of the people who have been trained throughout their education and then their careers to chase status. So you're losing this thing that you've spent so much time, invested so much in. It's only 3 years of law, 3 years of law school on top of undergrad, but it's still, you know, you've gone to college and graduate school for 7 years. I've definitely seen people have a hard time breaking free from that. But by the same token, I've seen the people who wrap their identities in being a lawyer, and I've met very few of them who are, I would consider, happy individuals. Right. So for me, that was one of the big things, was transitioning from valuing that status to valuing happiness. And there's not a lot of overlap in those two, at least I found.
One of your first points here is about transitioning your mindset about 2 to 3 years out. And I'm curious if you actually were able to do that through like learning from other people or just knowing yourself that you would need to start the transition earlier than maybe what you would think. Because again, I think back to Carl, and he, you know, he actually worked a little bit longer, but then he retired, and it's just like, okay, like now what? So did you actually start 2 to 3 years ahead of time?
I started about 2.5 years from when I left my job. I knew that I was going to be leaving my job, and I didn't know when, but I definitely knew I was not going to be pushing to try to make partner at the law firms. And it's up or out at the law firms too. And I was at that kind of stage where I was like, there's no way I want to be doing this. That would make me so miserable. And so I started to kind of adopt that mindset some more at work. Again, I've seen people have such a hard time. And the reason I say 2 to 3 years out and not sooner as well is kind of when you're in the thick of things, and especially if you're not at your fire number or you know, you're not at where you want to be at, it doesn't help you to start thinking about how miserable work is. It was kind of good that I was still all in and invested in things. But once I, you know, felt like I was getting close to that number, and maybe within a few years of that number, I thought making that transition was really helpful. And then I started, you know, to the extent I was mentoring, either officially or unofficially, some of the younger attorneys, I was like, if you want to be happy at the law firm, figure out your end game as soon as possible. If your end game is to leave and, you know, pay off your student loans and leave in 4 or 5 years, you can make your life for those 4 or 5 years a lot better than if you think like, oh, maybe I'll be partner, maybe I'll be head of the firm someday. Like, you know, if you go in with that mentality, you're just going to make yourself miserable, and only 1 out of 200 people who start at the firm are going to end up at that point. So the odds aren't in your favor. So 1 out of 10 will make partner and things like that. The sooner you can decide you're not going to push for whatever milestone, I feel like that's helpful. And I'm using the law firm as an example, but I think it would translate to a lot of different settings. Anytime you have that corporate ladder structure in place, when you can decide there's a rung at which you definitely don't want to get to, there's a lot of stuff that you can cut out, whether it's, you know, work happy hours that you don't want to go to, or extra committees that you know to volunteer or be a part of, or some assignment that's going to keep you busy over the weekend. You don't have to be doing all that extra stuff. And then that creates a little bit of space for other parts of your life to fill up.
One thing that I was pretty, I feel lucky now, is I didn't have much of an identity with the job that I had. Maybe it made like working a little bit more miserable, or I had, actually not miserable, maybe I just had a bad attitude at the time. But, you know, I did consulting, management consulting, and I was a project manager. And I think after I was like, you know what? These performance reviews are dumb and the promotion cycle is dumb. I still like played along a little bit, but at the end of the day, I was like a project manager for like iPhone billing software. It's just like fucking stupid. Like it really wasn't making much of a difference. And it was so silly when the managers would be like, yeah, like you really want to do this and you want to like have pride in your work. I'm filling in a lot of blanks, but basically I was just like, this is a fucking, like the whole thing is a fucking joke. Like it really doesn't matter that much. So again, maybe I had a little bit of a bad attitude, but it also like freed me from the identity of like a software project manager at this job. Cause I was like, even the directors, a couple of levels ahead of me, I was just like, you guys are doing the same shit. The whole thing is just silly. Yeah. So it was very easy for me when I got laid off / fired to transition into something else that I was working for myself, but even then, now where I said, I don't do the same thing. And I didn't take it that seriously when I was doing like SEO and affiliate marketing. I mean, I took it seriously in that I wanted to do good work and sell a good product and blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, I'm like, I'm not an affiliate marketer or an SEO where other people, like, it's part of their identity. So, and your note here is build an identity separate from how you earn money. So can you talk about how you did that specifically?
If I can, just following up on the one thing you said about performance reviews, that really like resonated with me. And it's kind of embarrassing to share, but my first job after my first year, the summer after my first year of law school, I got my first performance review. And there was one thing that was said in there, which it was fairly constructive, but it was still like a negative comment. And I could tell like someone, I had just annoyed someone with how I had presented something to them. And I like went back after that and I like closed the door in my office and I was crying because I mean, I had just had so much wrapped up in this becoming an attorney. And at that point too, you're still trying to like really prove yourself. And some of these things are kind of make and break, you know, I'm trying to get a job at this law firm. It's like the whole summer is not like a job interview essentially. And I don't think the person was, you know, I don't think I was like on the verge of not getting a job offer. Like I got a job offer from that firm, but it just
hit you.
It hit me because I had so much invested and wrapped up in that. And then like my last performance review was just, I mean, that was after I'd been fully slacking off and it was abysmal. And I was like, I don't care at all. The only thing I was like, did I slack off so much that I'm not going to get my bonus? And I was like, because I had, you know, your bonuses are determined by how many hours and I had sufficient hours. But then I was like, oh, was I too like gruff with this one attorney? But then I got my bonus and then I was like, oh, I don't care at all what that person said. And then I also had such an F you attitude too. And I felt like that attorney who had reviewed me had put some inaccurate things in the, like factually inaccurate, and being, you know, me being an attorney, I was like, well, that's a potential defamation case if they fire me. So I was like, this is great. I was like, I like might actually try to, you know, goat her into saying some more stuff like this for my own economic benefit. But anyways, that's the performance review piece of things. It was like, how did I build the identity separate? Was that the broader question?
I rarely remember the question, but in this case, yeah, that was the question. Okay.
So for me, building an identity separate from it is one thing, this is just a small thing, but I found it really helpful. But when people would ask me, you know, like, what do you do? Or, you know, would there be just kind of more of that general conversation, like getting to know someone, I would try to steer the conversation towards something that I was passionate about, a hobby or something. You know, we've talked a lot about travel and food and hiking while we were in Chicago. Those were our big, big hobbies. And I'd try to bring up, you know, a cool hike we had done or a trip we had been on or, you know, something we had cooked or a restaurant we had been to, and try to steer the conversation that way. And I mean, I found that I always enjoyed having those conversations much more than I did the conversations about like, oh, where do you work? What's your title? And especially in Chicago, that seemed to be the conversation that people were always trying to ask. And I would just try to steer the conversation in a different direction. The other piece of that was on the weekends or anytime I had free time, I tried to not think about work or do work at all. I tried to be focused on spending time with friends. If I was with friends, I would have my phone turned off or have the ringer turned off, so I would not be getting notifications. There were only a couple times where it maybe hurt me a little bit, but I was generally so responsive that, you know, no one's track record is 100% when it comes to responding to incoming requests immediately. And then, yeah, just, you know, spending time hiking when I had free time, instead of thinking about work or opening my work email, I would have go-to things that I would pull open, whether it was All Trails to, you know, search for new hiking spots, or, you know, the Eater Chicago page, mm-hmm. where it has the new restaurant reviews and stuff like that. And just try to always be looking at that stuff or researching a trip or something rather than doing that. And then one other component is I stopped reading for leisure for a long time. And we didn't go to the library. And with like a few years left, we went and got a library card, and I started reading a lot more again. And that was, I had not done it for a long time because I was reading so much for my job that it, you know, wasn't really like I needed more reading in my personal life. But I actually found that doing that really helped me start broaden interests. You discover new topics, and making space to read was really helpful in helping me develop my personal interests, as opposed to just always being mm-hmm. focused on work.
The other portion of this, you know, people have an identity related to their professional title, maybe how they earn money, of course. The other is around like the productivity portion. And I was doing an interview for my other show, and I was like, actually, it was right after the interview. And I was like, hey, my wife retired like a year ago. And I'm like, I'm semi-retired. I just do these podcasts basically. And she was like, retired? Like that's crazy. Like I would be so bored. Like I just have to be productive. And I'm like, I'm not fucking bored. Are you ever bored?
No, I was way more. It's comical. I was so bored so many days at my job too, where right. I just like did not want to be there. I'd be like forcing myself to write a memo or brief that I didn't want to be writing, that I'd been working on, you know, maybe for a week, and I just desperately wanted to go for a walk or do something. And so the idea that I would all of a sudden be bored because I could, you know, go for a walk or do whatever I wanted is it's comical. It's also like, what can you do if you're not working? It's like, you can literally do anything else in the world. You can do anything.
And I like the gal that I was chatting with, different perspective. She's a little bit younger. I think she's not super young. She's like 35 or 6 or so. But I think maybe she's self-employed now. I think maybe her business has just been growing in the last few years. So she's at a point where she's just like, you know, a lot of energy, really wants to prove herself and take advantage of like the opportunity that she's in right now. And I'm like on the other side of it. I think you're kind of on the other side, where I'm like, I don't have enough time to do the hobbies that I want to do right now. I'm like, I want to hike a little more, play guitar more, and do other stuff. And it's like, we can do all the things, just not all at the same time. So it's more of a time management thing, but I'm never bored. All that to say, a lot of the stuff that I do looks extremely not productive. And I think people have an issue with that. And we've grown up like, you know, if you could do work yourself, fucking do it. Don't hire someone else to do it. You need to be productive. You need to be doing things. And it's like, maybe it's better if you go for a walk, which looks pretty unproductive other than just like walking or hiking or sitting around playing guitar poorly, where I'm not, like, it's never going to produce any income or revenue. It's literally just like the same as reading, right? Like, you're just sitting there. It's for your own leisure activity, not much else. Any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think the idea that you always need to be productive is incredibly toxic and harmful. It's also a super American construct, I feel like. That's probably a separate point, but productivity is such a an interesting concept. The way that it gets used in the United States in particular is that if you're spending money or making money, you're doing something. And if you're not spending money or making money, then you're doing nothing. And if you just even take a step back and think about that, that's just so ridiculous. I mean, that would be like saying every animal other than humans doesn't do anything, you know, because, and then even with humans, it's like every human except for the ones who existed in the past 10,000 years hasn't done anything. It's not a very natural way of thinking about life. I do a lot of stuff during the day where I could go try to turn it into a business and sell it to people. And then all of a sudden people would think I was being productive. But, you know, I cook probably on average two meals a day for my family. If I was a private chef for a wealthy family and made them two meals a day, everyone would be like, okay, great, you're doing something. You're a private chef. Shopping for and making healthy food for my family is a very important thing. It definitely adds value to society, even if no one else is paying me for it. Even something like silly, like I like to walk the neighbor's dog. If I went and started a dog walking business, everyone would be like, okay, great, you're doing something. Now I'm interested in it. Now I want to ask you questions about it. But, you know, just going and taking the neighbor's dog for a walk, it's like, well, you didn't do anything that day. And then the big one, and this is the one that like economists always reference, it's if you watch your own kid, it's considered doing nothing. But if me and my neighbor were to switch and I were to watch their kid and they were to watch my kid and we were to each pay each other $40,000 a year for childcare, then we'd be considered doing something. It's like, what's the net output from that? It's no different than if we each just watched our own kids and didn't pay any money for it. So, you know, I've been able to wrap my head around those ideas. And when you know, it's such a knee-jerk thing. Like, you can tell probably that person who brought it up on your other podcast hadn't even thought a lot about it before. And I have a lot of empathy for those people as someone who was, you know, highly productive, especially in that, you know, in that phase, more of that like 20s, 30s phase of life. I totally understand where she's coming from. But once you have the perspective of doing nothing for a few years, you realize very quickly how silly those knee-jerk, you know, productivity responses are.
So, gotta keep moving on here. I forgot about the cooking interest that we have, but I was like, where do I spend my time? And I was thinking about it. Yeah, I enjoy going to the store. Like, I know you could order and like have it delivered. I don't mind going. I actually like going to the store, picking out whatever meat and thumping things or whatever, you know, you got to do, make sure they're ripe.
You get inspiration that way too.
Like
you see new ingredients or new cuts of meat or something.
Oh, and then like actually preparing it. So I was like going through the store and I was like, those pineapples, like a couple of these are actually ripe. So I was like, I'm going to get a couple pineapples. It was fucking awesome. And the thing is like, I mean, it's not hard to cut a pineapple, but most people would be like, how do I cut a pineapple? I don't know. I have nice knives as well. I think you do too. It's like, it's good to have the right tools and all that kind of stuff. But I was like, I haven't cut a pineapple in a little while, but it was super awesome and it was actually ripe and whatever it, cause I don't cut them that often. I probably spent 20 minutes or 30. I have no idea. It didn't matter how long it took, but I spent a pretty solid chunk of time like cutting the pineapple up. And I could talk about food. I'm starting to get hungry. We're going to have a smoked meatloaf later.
Pretty excited about that. Yeah.
So I am too. I'm getting hungry. So we'll keep moving on here. So one of the other notes that you mentioned here is to take all your vacation time. And I know when I got laid off and when I switched jobs, I basically had maxed out vacation time because while I do take time off, I always like took less. And I think that's very common for productive people to like not take the time off. So talk about using all your vacation time.
Yeah, I have thoughts on this from like a legal, just whatever boring legal perspective. It was a real rise while I was at the law firm doing some employment law that companies start switching from the, you know, set vacation time, however many weeks a year, 2, 4, you know, maybe 5, 6 if you're lucky. But companies start transitioning over to the unlimited vacation time. And the reason why they did that, and this is from my perspective as someone who had front row seats to companies making that decision, was that so they would not have to buy back vacation time from people when people would quit mid-year with unused vacation time.
No shit.
And so I just was like, that is so messed up. It definitely was never presented or marketed that way. And then after these policies were implemented, they realized that people were actually taking less vacation time yep. than they were before. So it's like double benefit to these, you know, like evil empire corporations. They're like getting more work out of you for, and they're not having to, you know, to pay you when you leave at the end of your job. So anyways, the company is very much trying to take as much of your time as possible. So it's at least take what you're due in terms of personal time, which is vacation, you know, which is your vacation time. For me, then it very much changed the whole feel of the entire year to have those vacations scheduled, to go on them. It felt like a lot of pressure off. My wife started getting, they called it summer Fridays, but she would get half. It was fairly, in hindsight, especially now that we're retired, it's fairly meager, but it was half days on Fridays in August. So yeah. 5 Fridays a year. But she was like, no, if they're doing this, I'm not going to be here on Friday afternoons in August. Summer's her favorite season by far. She's like, I'm going to go to the art museum. I'll go walk in the park. I'll go do anything. But for both of us to allow our personal lives to take at least that very, you know, in hindsight, moderate amount of space, was, it felt so freeing. And a 4-day work week feels so different than a 5-day mm-hmm. work week. You've cut out 20% of your work for the week. So we started doing that, and then planning some bigger vacations and mm-hmm. trying to creep out an extra day or two. You know, we start off only taking 7-day vacations, you know, and being afraid that would even be too much time away from the office. And then towards the end, we had like crept it out to 11 days, I think, was the longest vacation that we took. I feel like once you hit 2 weeks, people really do start to notice or whatever, and there start to be consequences. But
yeah. It's interesting. I can't remember. There's a couple of people that I've talked to where they're like, yeah, I've never had more than like a week off or something. And I'm like, what does that mean? Now, sometimes if it's a small business, I remember who I was talking to. It was a small business under 10 employees. So like each person was fairly critical, where we're talking like bigger corporate, the companies I worked for, it was like many thousands or tens of thousands of employees. One thing I did when... I think we were slow traveling, and we rented a house in Austin. This is like 10 years ago, but occasionally the company I was at, they would say, hey, you guys have to start using your vacation time. So I was like, cool. I'm taking Fridays off. This is going to be awesome. We would get brisket. And like when I was in Austin, I was like, I'm always getting brisket and sausage, because I can't get that very often back in Georgia at the time. They didn't like that. Yeah. that did not fly very well. I think I still did it, but eventually I got laid off. It's another story. Leads us into our other episode.
Reminds me, my employer put out their first mental health video, and they were like guilting people for not taking enough vacation time in that video. I forget the exact language, but it was like, vacations are an important part of like maintaining your mental health, and that makes you a good employee. So you have to prioritize it. And so that was, you know, designed by some HR person who actually, who probably had good intentions, but the reality, it was not written by any of the people I was working for. It definitely was not like written by the head of anyone's group. And then you'd go to the head of your group and be like, I'm take a vacation. And they would say, no, I'm be like, this, your own law firm said that this is critical to my performance and mental health. So, you know, it's very hypocritical of you to say, you know, whenever it was always like, they didn't mind the idea in theory of someone taking vacation, but they were always like, oh, but this week's no good, or, you know, that week's no good, and things like that. So, but when you're at a big company too, it's like, there's, you know, there's 22 people in my group who all know how to do everything that I do. Like, you can do your job as a manager and figure out how to have someone else cover my work for a week while I'm on vacation.
Yeah. And there's a handful of people that, if you identify with this, I'm not talking to you, so I don't want to offend anybody, but where they just think they're so important that like no one else can do their job. It's like, guess fucking what? So many people can do your job. Yeah. Probably the people on your team. If you just get out of the way and give them a chance, you'd be shocked what people can do. But it turns out, yeah, everyone's replaceable.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter too much. Okay. Another note that you have and some adventures you went on, travel to happy countries to see people that enjoy their lives. And I'm curious, any specific trips in mind on this?
We went to, I mean, just generally Europe is greater than the US. Australia and Singapore were pretty great. I don't know if I mentioned it this episode. My wife worked for United Airlines, so we had free flights around the world, which was awesome. So we got to see a lot of these countries. I remember this day. It was a very unproductive do nothing day, but we were in Copenhagen in August, and Scandinavian August, the whole country is basically on vacation. Sometimes even the restaurants are closed. I mean, it's almost so much vacation that it's inconvenient, because you know, you as a tourist, you're like, I need to be able to eat at a restaurant, or have the grocery store be open and things like that, rent a car, you know, things like that. We were just at this park in Copenhagen. We had gone to this market that was nearby. We got a couple of beers. We got some cheese and crackers and some grapes, or, you know, some other fruit there. And we went to this park and had a picnic, and we were just, you know, lying on the grass and then like looking up and at the sky, and it's really nice weather. It's not too hot. It's not too cold. But then we looked around the park, and it was a Wednesday at maybe 2:00, and it seemed like the whole city was doing the same thing that we were doing, and people were together with their friends and talking and laughing and enjoying themselves. And we came back to Chicago that, you know, the next weekend, and we were going on a walk in the park, and it's just, it was just such a different vibe. It was like, you know, to the extent people are even in the park, they're like hard charging, exercising, you know, playing some competitive sport. Maybe you see a few people reading, but they're, you know, they're the minority. That difference was kind of stark to us. We were like, you know, we don't have to be going this hard. It's not like Denmark's economy is in the toilet because no one's ever doing anything. They enjoy their lives, and they're plenty wealthy. The other one that stands out, we were in Switzerland we went on a trip to the Swiss Alps and the Dolomites. As I mentioned on a previous episode, they lost our luggage, and it was a holiday weekend for them. And they're like, we can't get you your luggage for 3 days. And I was like, what do you mean? And they're like, it's a holiday weekend. And me being American, I was like, that sounds more like a you problem than a me problem. But they're just like, we don't work. We don't work when it's a holiday. It's, you know, there are laws in place there are even laws in place in Switzerland where if you try to make someone work on their vacation time, you can, you know, you can have some financial repercussions for that. So it was not my favorite experience, having them lose my luggage and then not get it back to me for 4 days. But, you know, in hindsight, it's very educational to be like, oh, the Swiss actually value their time off and take it seriously.
Yeah. Well, and so I haven't done as much international travel, so I'll offer an alternative, and that's national parks or other places kind of in a general sense, like people may value freedom over money and status. And the thing is, with national parks, like people are on vacation, they're appreciating the outdoors typically. So that can work pretty well. However, I was just thinking of Yellowstone. So have you been to Yellowstone? Yep. But I was just remembering, like, they're a little bit of an American mentality where, you know, maybe I'll set up some chairs and sit down and watch Old Faithful a couple times. I have some great memories. I like brought the dog and like brought a cooler, had a couple beers and just sat there for 2 hours or something. Other people, they're like parking, running over there, watching Old Faithful erupt for a minute. They're impatient because it's not going off like right on schedule. Pretty faithful, but not completely.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And then they like run back to their car and like get the fuck out of there and go somewhere else. And they're like kind of rushing the whole experience. So there's like a little give and take, and you can go to maybe more remote parts of certain parks or less popular ones, or, you know, there's certain areas where like people are taking their time versus like trying to see the geyser erupt and then see the next thing on their checklist, you know.
I've generally found it, your comment reminds me about just Colorado in general. I think, you know, people here are happier. I think we, you know, we generally get rated as one of the happier states, or like Boulder gets rated as like the happiest city in the country and stuff like that. And so it's nice to be here. And you see that one thing is that people just want to take their time and go on a hike or bike ride. And that's the priority for the day. It's not as much of that, you know, live to work mentality. And then the mountain towns, I think, are great. Like, especially, you know, we have a pretty good community of friends up in Breckenridge, and mm-hmm. they're, you know, when the snow is good, the emphasis is on getting out and skiing. It's not like, oh, what's my work going to say? And even the employers understand that, like, on a good ski day, yep. you're not going to have your entire employee base show up. As you know, I was looking around when we were first in Breckenridge, I was looking around to see if there was any sort of fire community, and didn't find a lot of people who were interested in, or didn't seem like there were a lot of people who were interested in it. But then you start talking to all these different people about what their life actually looks like, and I'm like, they're happy right now. They don't need, you know, and they're not defining themselves by their mm-hmm. job and title. Their job is a way that they make money to support the lifestyle that they want to live, which they have being in the mountains. So yep. that's.
Yep. And that's the other sort of trick, like resort towns, which, you know, it's tough. I mean, if I feel like depending on the town, it could be hard for people to afford to live in a quote resort town because of the cost of real estate and all the other things that mm-hmm. make it very expensive. But sometimes, like you're saying, people are running on a different speed and they're appreciating life and they appreciate the freedom that they have versus like status or money or some other thing. So they're just like, I want to hike a bunch. It's really important to ski or whatever. Typically, it's like an outdoor thing. At least that's yeah. what I'm focusing on. So before we move on to the next couple items here, we do have a sponsor, and that is Ghost Bed. We have the Ghost Bed Lux. We have a queen size. We sometimes talk about upgrading to a king size bed whenever we're at an Airbnb. We're like, man, there's so much more room. You could like spread your arms out and there's just so much space. But anyway, we have a queen lux, really enjoy it. I'm a hot sleeper, as many people know. So the lux helps keep me pretty cool. Now I'm curious, Rusty, do you have any recurring dreams while you're thinking? I was trying to remember, like, I used to have a couple dreams way more often, but they haven't happened. And it was like from when I was a little kid, like I would remember someone chasing me like through the woods on a trail. And through the years I had that dream, but like now I haven't had it in so long.
Do you think it's the ghost bed?
I mean, I'm not 100% saying, but like, yeah. there's definitely a correlation. Yeah.
You're personally guaranteeing that if you get a ghost bed, you won't have any more nightmares.
100%.
Yeah.
110%. Yeah. 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 Do you have any recurring dreams?
last time I was on, you asked me about the whether or not I still had the work nightmares, and I was having them at that time. I was also going through this therapy. It's called EMDR. I forget what it's even what EMDR stands for, but it's like something to do with your eye movement. And if you keep your eyes bouncing back and forth, it switches your brain back and forth between the left, like the literal left side of your brain and the right side of your brain. Oh. And then the therapist prompts you to, you know, think about whatever it is. Like, you know, I would start off thinking about work, and then my brain is bouncing back and forth, and you start just like different images, experiences flash through things. And it basically is supposed to reprogram your brain so that you have a more holistic sense of that experience. And you can also tap into like your present calmness and know that whatever that experience was in the past, you know, in the moment you're calm, so that, you know, that experience didn't overconsume you. But first time I was on the show, I was still having those nightmares. You'd asked me about it, and I was like, I'm actually in therapy for it right now. And then I did the actual reprocessing with that, and I haven't had a nightmare about work since that. So
interesting. Wow. Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, and this is one of the best integrated ads that I've done, because like this was literally on our outline to discuss. Interesting. Did you do the therapy specifically for the dreams and maybe anxiety, if I place that word, of work?
Yeah, I mean, there was another event, family health related, that triggered the therapy. But once you're in the therapy, it's like you can choose what you want to work on. So like working on that, that was a specific target of, you know, one of these sessions. And then the other thing that I still have the nightmares about sometimes is the like high school, like high school test, or like I'm supposed to go take a test that I haven't studied for, a class I haven't studied for, which is so, you know, so silly as, you know, now 41-year-old to still have those. But I also think high school is a traumatic experience for, I would say, most people. Yeah. So that, you know, that's another target for this.
That's funny. I forgot. That probably is the recurring dream that I have. So high school wasn't as traumatic. College was more traumatic. So my recurring dream is like, I'm in this class, and it almost always like spans the semester or whatever term or whatever. So it's like,
that's right.
I'm like, I went to the class, and then I was like, oh yeah, I don't need to go that often. And then I show up for the final, and I'm like, oh fuck, I was supposed to work on this project the whole time, and I completely didn't work on it the whole time. I had months to do it. And I show up and I'm stressed out. Oh no, I'm probably going to have one of those tonight.
I feel like I lost you for a second there, Doug. You're back in that stress state.
Yeah. I was like, oh no. Yeah. But since I've been sleeping in a ghost bed, I've had zero of those dreams. So I think people should check it out. You can save 10% if you use the code MILEHIFI, or if you just go to ghostbed.com/MILEHIFI. And they have tons of different mattresses. Like I said, I have the Luxe, but it's one of the softer ones, and people like firmer. And there's many different options. So you could take the 3-minute sleep quiz there and check it out. And of course, thanks to Ghostbed for sponsoring the show.
Do you think you will go for the king size at some point?
I think so. Every time we get back from a trip, and we just got back a couple days ago, Elizabeth is like, those king's beds they're pretty nice, aren't they? And I'm like, yeah, you know what? They're pretty nice.
I do feel like if you sleep hotter too, it's nice to have the extra room in between your sleeping partner. I feel like that makes
a difference.
We went, from queen to king maybe like 6 or 7 years ago. And the first night I was like, this is so, this is so much better. I have an extra 18 inches of space, you know, to cool off. So
it's great. Yeah. It's crazy how much bigger like it feels. Cause I think technically it's like, it's not that much bigger, right?
I don't know. Yeah. It feels a lot bigger. That's for sure.
Okay. So back on topic here, one of the notes you have is around body-based trauma therapy. And I'd ask you what this was. So can you let us know for the uninitiated?
Well, the EMDR was, these are I'm speaking to my experience. And this is by no means an area that I'm expert in, but the EMDR that I just discussed, the reprocessing was really, really interesting. I found that work was a traumatic experience. I didn't think about it that way at the time, but anytime you are sat inside, forced to be in front of a computer for, 50 plus hours a week, and you're not allowed to direct your own time. You have someone else directing your time, and then eating into all of your personal time to the extent you can never relax. It's not the most severe form of trauma that someone could experience, but I think in hindsight, I think it was traumatic, or at least it helped me to frame it that way for the purposes of pursuing the therapy. But the broader point, and why I think the body-based stuff was really helpful, is I think throughout my education, being an athlete and then also working at a fairly demanding job, I had basically learned to tune out my body, or, kind of embrace those messages you receive, especially, playing sports like suck it up, pain is weakness, leaving the body, push hard, to such an extent where I was, waking, like in college, I'd wake up at 5 a.m. 6 days a week and go work out. So I was, had all that stuff, I feel like, kind of to the extreme. I realized that a lot of the times, especially when I was at work, my body was trying to tell me that I was miserable, and I was just... my approach was just basically, shut up, body, we're fine. We have to do this, whatever. We have to get this project done. And so the one of the big body-based therapy that I did was called somatic therapy. And it's basically trains you to check in with your body, basically develop the neural connections from your body to your brain, so that your brain can receive that information and your actions are informed by what your body's experiencing, as opposed to ignoring it. But my first day in therapy, my therapist was like, what's your body feeling like? What are you feeling in your body right now? And I was like, I'm feeling like I have to do this and this and this. And it was like, well, those aren't feelings. Those are actions. That's, you're inside your head. We need you to get kind of back inside your body. They do some not extreme things, but they do things that will develop a strong emotional reaction in you. Like, you have to push against the wall. One of the first things my therapist had me do was push against the wall as hard as I could until I was lightheaded, stopped just short of the passive point of passing out. And then she's like, describe what you feel in your body. And you're like, well, I've seen stars in my eyes. I feel a lot of pressure in my head. I feel tightness in my arms from where I was pushing. And it's, you get to the point where your body doesn't have to be in that extreme of a position for you to be, be in touch with what it's feeling. And then I was doing that. And then my last few years of work, I had this added power of being in touch with my body. And when people would say things to me that I didn't like, my body would, my body would tell me immediately, hey, that guy's being a real jerk to you right now. You should tell him that that's not appropriate. And so I had that experience of more kind of standing up for myself, or allowing the way that I was living to be more consistent with my, what I was actually feeling in the moment. And that started to feel like really good. And then I wouldn't have a lot of those regrets where, oh, I should have said this to that person, or, you'd still be processing things 3 days later. It would just happen in the moment. I'd say how I felt in the moment, handle the situation then, and then I could go on to the next moment and not have those things kind of nag at me. But by the same token, if I would have gone in with that mindset to my first job at the law firm, I think I would have lasted about 2 weeks. So
yeah,
it was, yeah.
Interesting. And you have a couple of book recommendations here. You want to mention them real quick?
Oh yeah. There's The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk. He's been on some podcasts too that are good. So if that's more of the way people take in information, in particular, he's been on the Feel Better, Live More podcast a few times. That I would consider that my go-to podcast for health stuff. Gabor Mate has one called When the Body Says No. And what's really interesting about that one is that he ties this disconnect between the mind and body to a bunch of diseases that basically will not present themselves unless you have this psychological condition. So you're not only improving your mental health, but your physical health by strengthening this connection. The other one is a memoir, more of a memoir. It's by Dr. Russell Kennedy. and it's called Anxiety RX. And he was a medical doctor who just was extremely unhappy and realized he needed, and, you know, was suicidal and realized he needed to do something differently, and kind of went on this process of doing these somatic therapies. And he's like, it didn't just change my behaviors. It cured my anxiety, where I'm no longer an anxious person as a result of doing that.
Wow. Okay. So we'll link up so people could check those out if they want. And one thing that I realized, Rusty, is I really enjoy talking with you, and it makes us go longer than I ever intend. So I'm gonna truncate some of what I was going to say here so that we can get some of that delicious meatloaf in a second. But you have a handful of things that you asked for from your employer when you knew you were going to leave, and I'll let you hit like the top couple or three that you definitely want to mention. I'll mention, again, very truncated. We moved to Bozeman, and I didn't tell my company, and basically we moved, and then I called them and I was like, hey, we moved, would love to work it out, and I hope you want to, but if not, that's okay. And then they, in air quotes, laid me off a few weeks later. They were like, I think we could work it out. And then I was on the front end of layoffs. They kind of fired me now that I look back. But it was the greatest thing ever. And I didn't even realize it was like an FU money move, but it definitely was. I was just like, hey, here's a situation. It's like, it's your decision. What do you want to do? That was pretty fun. A huge ask. And they were like, no, get the fuck out of here, which was the right answer for what I did. So what were the big asks? Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
I love that. Now it makes mine like seem small. Oh. I wish I would have gotten to that point. I think you can, I mean, I called it my victory lap because I had a more like sequential where I was like, oh, I'll ask for this and then this and keep asking for bigger and bigger things, but they were just shutting down everything. So I started off small and I was just basically trying to improve my working conditions. I was on this big case that was taking up a lot of my time and I didn't care for it. And so I just was like, hey, can I just rebalance my workload a little bit? Maybe we bring someone else on that case. Maybe we bring in, I had one more junior person working for me. I was like, maybe we can bring in someone else. I can oversee them and it frees up some of my time to do some other things. They said no to that. I said, you know, I'd like to work for this partner, that partner. I'd like to do this sort of work more, that. They said no to that. Eventually the goal would have maybe been to get to a point where it was like, oh, well, I'm going to go live somewhere else and work remotely or make something big like that. And then at the end, they had said no to everything. And that's tying it back into our early conversation. That was like, well, fuck it. Like if this is a transaction, they can't meet any of my objectives like at all, then I'm at least going to take all my vacation time. Like that's within my control and I don't even have to get their, you know, their permission for that. So that was where I finally landed. And then towards the end, they weren't asking me anymore, but I was like, I'm not going to seek out extra work or try to kill myself. That's where I was. I can slack off and stuff like that. So,
yeah.
So those, that's what I ended up getting in the end, and they weren't given to me or anything like that. But I was also at the point where it's like, if they fire me, doesn't matter. I was going into those conversations and whatever, taking advantage of my anonymity here. I was like, we have almost $3 million. Like, they can't really mess with me that bad. It was the FU attitude from, you know, inaction. I'm like, I'm going to ask for this thing. The worst thing they can say is no. And if they say no, I can just be like, okay, well, I'm going to go slack off then. So,
it's very interesting. So we encourage people to like ask for what you want. It's a transaction and like your employer, mostly talking about bigger companies. Number one, they don't give a fuck about you. I know your immediate manager, a lot of people have a nice relationship and they're like, oh yeah, my manager is really great and blah, blah, blah. But you know what? They'll lay you off if their boss tells them to lay you off. Right. In a second, they're like, oh, it's just business. You could also treat it like a business and like ask for exactly what you want, try to negotiate way outside for like what, like I said, I was like, I moved. What do you want to do?
Yeah.
you could give it a shot. And of course, like, if you need the job, you have to tread lightly. But once you reach some point, then you can ask for whatever you want. They can say no, and you could walk, or you could stick around and keep trying.
Even if you like the job, it's like, I'd like this. If you're like, I'd like this job better if I was living in Bozeman, you can ask for as big as possible. And I feel like employers have no problem asking for as big a thing as possible. I mean, they're constantly like, can you work all the time for no money? That would be our ideal scenario. Or can we pay you less or fire you the second that, you know, it's you know, we have a business need to do so. So
give it
a shot. You can ask for some things.
And I feel like maybe Carl has heard more stories where, like, you ask for it and people got it. I didn't really get for anything that I ask for, I just started doing stuff.
Mm-hmm. That's,
which is the other option.
Kind of experience too. Yeah.
We'll end it here. So, Rusty, always fun. Any things to wrap it up here? Any inspiring words you want to share? If not, that's totally okay. But if you want to wrap it up, you can.
No, I mean, I think we covered it. Nice. I think we did it.
All right. Well, thanks. And we do have another episode coming up in another time we're going to have to record later. But it's about quitting versus getting fired, which I think we'll be able to, like, share more of our own experiences in there too. So thanks again. Always fun.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks, Doug.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week.
I'm curious, as a fan of the show, I've heard that you sold your truck, and I also know you got the e-bike recently. We're a one-car household. We have two e-bikes, so more e-bikes than cars, but I wonder how the transition has gone for you.
It's been going well so far, so I'm trying to remember. I think I sold my truck in early April-ish or so, and it was still just a little bit too cold to, like, bike too much. And the good part, maybe similar to y'all, like, it's pretty unusual for both of us to need the car at the same time. It does happen, but through a little coordination, like, it's not usually a problem, at least so far. So yeah, it's been good. I don't miss my truck too much. I think mentally I was thinking about selling the truck for a few years, so it's totally okay. And I can't remember if I told you, but, like, the main prompt is I needed to get the emissions done and the registration. Oh, yeah. So I was like, shit. All right, I'm going to try to sell it. And I don't remember how much I said on the episode, but, like, selling it on Craigslist was an awesome experience. Like, I enjoyed the marketing of it and then the negotiation. There's a certain amount of bullshit you have to put up with from a spam perspective and just scammers. But it's pretty easy to sort through any of that. If anything seems weird, then get out. It should be a relatively good transaction. But interesting with the e-bike. So I don't feel comfortable riding on the road too much. And luckily we're on the greenway. So I did ride the bike to the dentist, and I only needed to be on the road for, like, super short amount of time. And I probably could have avoided it completely, but it was like half a mile or something like that. On the way back, I was going to hop on the sidewalk to cross the road just in the crosswalk, but there was like no cars around. So I actually like pulled into the turn lane for a traffic light. And I was like, okay, this is cool. There was a car approaching from behind me. And there was also the light had turned red in the oncoming traffic or whatever. Anyway, I waited because there was a truck coming pretty fast. And I'm like, fuck, I'm not pulling out in front of the truck until I see it's actually stopping and whatever the fuck it's going to do, which is a side note. I'll go on a tangent in a second. But anyway, the car behind me came up, and as soon as the light turned green, like I'm waiting for the truck to stop. It's not clear that it's going to stop. And they blew their horn at me like right fucking away. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, like I mean, when I'm driving, I don't enjoy bikes on the street. And basically I was just like, fuck, like I should just cross. Cause I hate that kind of stress, and it's a little dangerous. People driving are in a hurry. They're on their phone. Like it's not a good trade-off for me. The small risk. And then the other side tangent, then I'll let you ask more questions. When I'm in a car at a red light, I don't pull off right away because people run the fucking lights all the time. Right. And we live not too far from Highway 287. It's like Main Street here in Longmont. And like many streets all across the country, it's say 55 to 75 miles an hour is how fast people truly drive on it. And there's traffic lights along the way in major intersections. And that's where people die. And I've seen it multiple times where I wait for a second when the light turns green, a car flies by going like 70 miles an hour. And I'm like, that totally would have killed everybody involved. So anyway.
And even if you were in a car in the situation you described where you're waiting a little bit extra after the light turns green, you could have gotten honked at, but it just feels so much more aggressive and threatening when a car is honking at a bike. So it's the sort of thing I do think now, you know, we're well more than like a decade into city biking. So we're a little bit more immune to it. And I think you just also have to do what's safe. And for my legal perspective, I'm like, the person behind me isn't going to pay my medical bills if I pull out into the intersection and I get hit. So I don't owe them anything, you know? So, you know, we just do what we're comfortable. We do find ourselves being more comfortable and taking risks now that we weren't, you know, taking as much before. My wife would only, when we started biking in Chicago, she had grown up on a farm. So like her experience biking involved no traffic at all. And when we started biking in Chicago, she was, you know, pretty nervous and would only cross in the like pedestrian crossings and wouldn't use the street intersections. But yeah, now we've gotten, you know, both her and I are pretty comfortable doing that sort of thing. So, and especially at like those super busy intersections, like, you know, the 287 ones you're describing. So,
So it's been good. And like I said, we're right on the greenway. So there's a lot of places that we can get to very easily, minimal time on the road, if any. And the good thing, like, it's Boulder County. Like, people are used to seeing bikes on the road.
Definitely.
All the time. They may not like it, but there are bikes around pretty often.
Do you think you'll stay with just one car for you and Elizabeth?
Yeah, I think so. For a little while, she would answer differently.
Yeah.
But I was like, at least a couple years to see how it is. They're similar to like owning a home versus renting. It's like, oh, it feels like it's throwing money away. But it's like, when you came in, we were chatting, like there's a hole in the irrigation. Like we have to, like there's maintenance and there's shit you have to do. And it's not cut and dry. So I'm like, you know what? If I have to rent a car and pay, like I'm taking a trip in a few weeks, I'm going to rent a car probably for a week. It'll probably cost $500 or something like that. I priced it out a little bit and I was like, crap, that's a little more pricey than I thought. Still cheaper than if I took my truck in and I was like, it's 20 years old. What work do we need done? Like there's going to be some significant cost on that.
So. That's what we do. The times when we really need a second car, we will rent it. Enterprise is great that, you know, they pick you up as per their old commercials. Yeah. So you don't even have to arrange transportation to their store. And then we just find that it's only a few, you know, probably 10 days a year, maybe 15, that we actually need the second car, and it's not that inconvenient to rent. Yeah. And then you get good loyalty points from the rental car company too.
Yeah. And I was like, I'll probably get an Uber here or there also. But yeah, when you pull everything back, I'm like, that could be a nice thing to try. Maybe it turns out it's not a good move for us, but I think we should be able to make it work out. But yeah, Elizabeth, a couple of times she's like, oh yeah, like if we wanted to get a blah, blah, blah. And I was, well, let's give this a shot. Let's give it some time and see. So cool. How long have you guys been doing the one car?
We were no car for 10 years, and then there's one car for, I think it's been around 4 years now. Yeah.
Okay. So you guys went from zero to one.
Yeah. And our goal is to use the one car as little as possible. It's been tricky now, but we've had stretches even since getting the car where we've gone 3 weeks without using it.
That's pretty good.
And not like we're challenging ourselves. We're just, you know, just taking the bikes naturally, especially when the weather is nice, like it has been.
You know? Yeah. It's pretty nice. Do you guys take the bikes grocery shopping and stuff?
We do. Yeah.
Okay.
We have the trailer for our son, and then you can fit, it's like a two kid trailer. So you can fit about three grocery bags in there with our son. So
not bad. And I think, yeah, so I have a basket on there. But it's not as big as I thought it was going to be. It could hold a decent amount, but like really I need to figure out how to like strap a cooler on there, mm-hmm. which is doable in theory. We'll see if I actually like go grocery shopping, because I would go to, there's a Costco is like super close, but I kind of like Sam's, whole other story. Anyway, yeah. It's been good. It's been good to not have the truck.
Well, sounds like a fun experiment. So sounds like it's going well.